Welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 6th of March, with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up this week, we've got some highlights from a recent Innovation Forum webinar, where I was joined by Yum Brands' John Hixon, Mondelez International's Christine McGrath, and Nestle's Anna Terrell. We talked about the action that the food sector is taking to tackle climate change and make the necessary cuts in emissions if we're going to limit global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Our panel gives some great insight, so it's well worth a listen. All that's to come, but first, the usual roundup of some sustainable business news. Emerging from a recent Food and Agriculture Organization meeting in Rome have been proposals calling for wealthy developed economies to make significant financial contributions to poorer, less well-developed countries to protect biodiversity. Paying to reflect the value everyone derives from the ecosystem services provided by the Amazon rainforest, for example, could be part of a United Nations agreement on nature similar to the Paris Agreement on climate change. The Paris Agreement does, of course, have some provision for small-scale ecosystem protection, specifically to reduce emissions from land degradation and deforestation. But the new proposals would go further to develop science-based global diversity goals to head off the mass extinction that many scientists are now predicting. Bill Gates-backed Breakthrough Energy Ventures is heading a new $20 million round of investment in a New York-based startup working on developing synthetic alternatives to palm oil. C16 Biosciences uses microbes to convert byproducts from industrial processes and food waste into oil that can be used in place of palm oil. Given the market for the commodity is going to be worth, by some estimates, some $93 billion by 2021, there is inevitable interest in finding low-impact alternatives without deforestation risk. Scalability is, inevitably, the obvious stumbling block. A new methodology has been released by the Plastic Leak Project to map, measure and forecast how much plastic and microplastic leakage occurs across value chains. The project was initially kicked off last year by Qantas and EA and counts Mars, McDonald's, Plastics Europe and Adidas among its 35 business and public sector backers. Leakage is defined as plastic that is not managed at end of use or recycled via a circular economy model. The project provides guidelines that enable companies to identify potential leakage hotspots and develop appropriate remedying measures. Some estimates have plastic recycling rates at only 9% worldwide. And a lack of recycling has led California-based Earth Island Institute to sue a number of large companies and brands, including Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Colgate, Palmolive and others, for being responsible for plastic pollution and for being misleading about plastic recycling. The Institute says that companies responsible for selling the plastic products that end up in the oceans or elsewhere in the environment should be held to account. The lawsuit would also require companies to stop labelling products as recyclable when they are not in fact typically recycled. The Institute blames brands for engaging in what it calls a decades-long campaign to deflect blame for the plastic pollution crisis to consumers and more general misinformation around the benefits of recycling when there is in fact not a market for most plastics to be recycled. It's a few weeks until the first in Innovation Forum's 2020 conference programme. On the 18th and 19th of March, we'll be in London for the Ethical Trade and Human Rights Forum. Among the confirmed speakers are business experts from Mondelez International, Mars, AB InBev and Freshfields. Our New York Ethical Trade and Human Rights event is on the 5th and 6th of May. If you attend, you'll hear from senior representatives at Walmart, Microsoft, Intel, PepsiCo, Hilton, Tyson Foods and Timberland. On the 28th and 29th of April, we'll be in Amsterdam for the Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Conference. Among the experts joining us will be representatives of Primark, H&M, Tommy Hilfiger, CNA and Eileen Fisher. And we will be convening the 2020 Future of Food US Forum in Minneapolis on the 27th and 28th of May and be hearing from the likes of Walmart, Danone, General Mills, Yum Brands and McCain. Register to join them before close of business on 6th of March and save $300 on full price tickets. Finally, joining us at the London Future of Food event on the 2nd and 3rd of June will be key people from Unilever, Nestle, Quorn, IKEA and Tiger Brands. If you sign up to join us by the 20th of March, you can save £300 on conference passes. As you would expect, at Innovation Forum, we are very aware of the latest developments around the coronavirus outbreak. We are continually keeping up with the latest information and guidelines from government and health agencies in the UK and wherever we are holding events, and we'll follow their advice in full. Currently, the advice is that, with appropriate precautions, meetings such as our events may proceed. We feel it is important that our forums go ahead and that the important conversations still take place. Of course, we will keep delegates updated if there are any further developments. Coming up now are highlights of a recent Innovation Forum webinar, where I was joined by John Hickson, Vice President of Government Relations and Global Citizenship at Yum Brands, Christine McGrath, Vice President and Chief of Global Impact, Sustainability and Wellbeing at Mondelez International, and Anna Terrell, Head of Sustainability for Nestle UK and Ireland. Among the issues we talked about were how these companies are adapting practices to meet climate goals and the challenges around setting the right science-based targets. John at Yum Brands, what are you doing as a business to keep your global emissions in line with the IPCC 1.5 degrees centigrade goal? And what evidence do you have of your actions' effectiveness?
It's an exciting time to kind of work around climate impacts in food and agriculture. I don't think I've ever seen kind of more energy in this space. So the urgency is there. But the nice thing is, I think the corporate efforts and the private sector and public sector efforts are coming together in a really nice way. So it's a pleasure to be here on such an important topic. First, I guess from a Yum Brands perspective, just for those that don't know, I'll start. Yum Brands is KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut. We operate 49,000 restaurants around the world through a system of franchisees. So it makes it a really interesting challenge to cover all those individual locations. We don't have kind of large single factories per se. Those would be in our purchased goods and in our supply chain. So that's kind of a little bit of Yum. Our work in climate change really began a little over a decade ago and really anchored around our restaurants, knowing the proliferation of our footprint on that restaurant size, the food company. We just celebrated this past year 10 years of having LEED certified buildings for our restaurants in all of our major geographies, and also have a long history of CDP disclosure. But I will admit, most of our entryway into climate change and greenhouse gas reduction was really on scope 1 and 2. So the emissions directly from our facilities or the emissions directly purchased for the energy in our facilities. And that's what we have historically measured and disclosed. And then that's where we've got the best track record, I would say, too, relative to your question of kind of what have the results been. We're proud of the 4.3 billion megawatts of electricity that have been saved since 2005 and the efforts we've really worked hard at driving down metric tons of CO2 emissions per restaurant. It's under 236 tons now, where it was over 400 7 years ago. I think on that side, it's been a nice journey and a great trajectory. We're just trying to maybe catch up a little bit with where Mondelez and Nestle are now on scope 3. We're deep in the middle of target setting around science-based targets for a 1.5 degree target. For those of you who have not gone through that process, the first step in that is setting an inventory. So we're deep in reaffirming and checking all of our inventory on 1 and 2, and now digging into our scope 3 emissions. And that's where we see the greatest work plan kind of rolling forward. And for us, that'll particularly be around chicken, poultry, and dairy, and our cheese, and on our beef. And we'll have much more robust programs. We're kind of in the process of developing those. And then I guess just one little thing before I turn over to other panelists too, is one other key element of greenhouse gas reduction is trying to minimize the footprint, trying to address deforestation, land use conversion. Also have comprehensive goals around deforestation on palm, fiber, beef, and soy. And I think you can't look at greenhouse gas without kind of both greenhouse gas and deforestation in the conversation. So that's another mechanism we've really sought to drive down and try to work with our supply chain, principally through that land conversion and forest element of it. So those are the highlights of kind of the Yum overall efforts in this space, in restaurant and through the supply chain, and kind of where we are on the journey.
Thanks, John. What were the main challenges for you then in developing your science-based targets?
I think the biggest challenge internally for us, I spent most of my career in the food systems space, largely in kind of larger plant operators. I think the interesting challenge for Yum is the global diversity of our system and 145 countries, 49,000 restaurants, and we tend to source very locally. So for us, it's not like we've got a handful of concentrated areas. We literally purchase local chicken on the bone in almost every market we're in. So I think it's a bit of a challenge to get your mind around, okay, how do you boil this down into some action steps that seem to make sense and we can consistently apply across the system, given the diffuse kind of nature of our system and the diffuse nature of our sourcing.
Turning to Chris at Mondelez, same question to you, Chris. What are you as a business doing to keep global emissions in line with the IPCC 1.5 degree goal? And what evidence do you have for your action's effectiveness?
So building off of what John said, for us at Mondelez, just for perspective, we are one of the world's biggest snack food companies. And we have brands like Oreo and Cadbury, Toblerone chocolate, etc. So a little bit of a different business. And for us, our overall mission is about snacking made right and leading the future of snacking by making the right snack for the right moment in the right way. And that last piece of in the right way is really where our sustainability efforts fit in. And we view the work that we're doing to address climate impact as being really essential to our business. Very much a business strategy. It's reducing our environmental footprint is an urgent priority for us because of the impact that we see that climate change is having on people and the planet, and particularly the communities that grow the ingredients that we rely on for our brands. So for us, it's an imperative to future business growth. Our focus is primarily on sustainable ingredients because when we look at our overall environmental footprint, they represent about 60% of our greenhouse gas emissions. And so to make a meaningful impact in reducing climate change, we need to focus there. That's not the only thing that we do, but that's a key focus for us, particularly on ingredients like cocoa, palm oil, wheat, etc. One example of work that we're doing is Cocoa Life. We are one of the world's largest cocoa buyers, and so we're working to help transform the cocoa supply chain. Cocoa is absolutely essential to chocolate, obviously. Our mission is really cocoa made right. So we've invested through Cocoa Life. We have a $400 million commitment. We started back in 2012. And we are about 8 years into our journey, and we are addressing a fairly complex set of issues with that are interrelated. And really, the way that we believe to help tackle deforestation is helping farmers grow more cocoa on less land, helping them to have improved incomes by doing so, helping them to learn how to build more vibrant communities in which they live. And when that whole system works together better, it actually tackles some of the root causes that lead to deforestation and have that negative impact on climate change. So in terms of the results that we're seeing, we have a pretty extensive set of requirements for cocoa to be considered Cocoa Life. At the end of last year, we're at about 60% of our cocoa requirements are now sourced through the program for our chocolate brands. We're on our way to getting to 100% of our chocolate being sourced through Cocoa Life by 2025. So we're making really good progress there in ramping up. I guess some other things I would offer, and we can talk more about it, is that one of the things, as John said, you know, the, sort of the focus that the industry has on tackling climate change, tackling deforestation is greater than it's ever been. But I think there's a recognition that no one company, everyone's got to do their individual efforts, and we need to work together and collaborate more broadly with each other and with other key stakeholders, like the farmers, the local communities, the government, civil society, et cetera. So that's something that we're very focused on in cocoa, in palm oil, et cetera, through various industry coalitions. And then, of course, within our own operations, we've been focused for years on reducing our own CO2 emissions within our factory walls, and we're making good progress there. We're on track to reduce our own emissions by 15% by the end of 2020. And we have done a lot of work to set a full and science-based target, which we've done to tackle the scope 3 as well and get to well below 2 degrees. And so that will take us to an additional end-to-end goal of reducing CO2 by 10% by 2025. And that's been a really interesting journey in terms of the work it takes to understand what are the drivers of CO2 emissions, greenhouse gases, and what are the different levers to pull to be able to best reduce, make reductions across the business.
Your Cocoa Life program is fascinating. How did you develop the business case internally to improve your supplier livelihoods? I mean, a huge part of this is, as you mentioned, making farms viable that are becoming unviable. But how have you developed the business case internally to really drive that forward?
Really, honestly, tackled it. I had a background in marketing and new product innovation and came into cocoa really sort of with that perspective and started just analyzing where were we at in our cocoa supply chain, where were we with our sustainability efforts, looking at the work that we were doing on the ground with our certification partners. We were buying certified cocoa at that point, and we also had a pilot project in Ghana through Cadbury, the Cadbury Cocoa Partnership. It took us about a year, I would tell you, to develop the full business plan for Cocoa Life before we launched it. And that involved a lot of smart people who really understood the drivers of the issues and were experts in knowing what are the environmental solutions that might work, the social solutions that might work, how do you put all that together, how might we be able to measure it, etc. So I think what was essential for us was having it be like any other innovation platform and having 10-year P&Ls, looking at the investment. Literally, I had spreadsheets that looked at, you know, to get to our full cocoa supply, how many trees would we need to plant? What did we think the yield could be? How much did we think we could get through good agricultural practices, et cetera? What kind of support we would need to put in for farmers to get all of that done? And really did a bottoms up year by year P&L to be able to look at the business case. But that strong foundation, I think, is essential. And it's not just for a program like Cocoa Life. I think even taking sort of that business rigor of understanding the investment and what do you think the outputs can be for any one of these kinds of programs for CO2 reduction is, I think, really important for businesses to, at least internally, to feel good that, you know, I know one of the themes here is, do you feel like you're really going to be able to achieve it? And I think that kind of rigor is essential to know whether you think you can and what's the investment required.
Sure. And I guess using business language is important. If you're communicating with other colleagues internally, using a common language and the language of business is how you're going to get these programs developed. Chris, thanks so much. But Anna, let me turn to you. For you at Nestle then, what are you doing as a business to keep global emissions in line with the IPCC 1.5 degree goal? And what is the evidence you have of your actions' effectiveness?
For fear of kind of stating the obvious, let me start by just setting the scene in reflection to that bigger question around the kind of intersection between agriculture and climate change. So we know that agriculture both contributes to climate change and is obviously directly affected by climate change. And that's very much front of mind for Nestle and our approach to tackling the commitments we've made, but the issues that we're seeing. So in addition to needing to reduce GHG emissions across our value chain, and particularly in our upstream agricultural supply chain, we also need to be looking at adaptation of food production as a system to cope with climate change. So that's very much an integrated part of our kind of systems thinking, if you like, in the approach we're taking. Last year, we made a global commitment to be net zero by 2050, which is quite aligned with a number of other companies as well as national governments, which is fantastic. I think that's really helpful in demonstrating that there's a building momentum behind this kind of common ambition and where we need to get to. In terms of how we get there, we are very much in the process of developing our roadmaps, including our decarbonization roadmap. Now, the starting point for us is that Nestle is the world's largest food and beverage manufacturer. We're present in nearly 190 countries around the world. We have huge value chains and particularly agricultural supply chains. And when we've looked at the data, and obviously these science-based targets are absolutely critically important, but also making sure that the data that sits underneath it as the baseline is really robust, which in itself can sometimes be challenging. When we've looked at the data, it's really clear that nearly all of our total GHG emissions sit within scope 3, so indirect emissions across our value chain. More than half of them sit within our upstream agricultural supply chains. What that says is obviously that the way in which we need to go about achieving emissions reductions looks very different from how we would normally directly manage our own operations. And our operational footprint is actually pretty good. We've been working for years on the environmental efficiency of our factories and our sites, as well as our distribution centers and our networks, whether that's on carbon and energy or it's on food loss and waste. We've got a pretty good system working. There's always obviously more that we can do, but that's kind of well in play. The area that's kind of a little bit more new territory is this indirect piece, and particularly with the supply chain. We're in the process of developing our roadmap at the moment, which we'll obviously look to publish as soon as we can. That will lay out really the pathway for decarbonization up until that 2050 date. 2050 is a great date to put line in the sand, but obviously action needs to happen way quicker than that. And particularly the next 10 years are going to be absolutely critical in terms of the action that we as a company and as an industry in food and bev can actually make to get well on the journey. The approach we're taking is threefold. We're looking at the agricultural supply chains, we're looking at the ingredients that we're sourcing and the sourcing practices, which is a really important piece of the solution. We're looking at commodities, including how biodiversity plays in there. So looking at the upstream ag supply chain. We're looking at our own operational footprint, obviously, part and parcel of it. And we're also looking at portfolio transformation. So what does the future portfolio need to look like in order to fit into a world where we're actually able to achieve net zero? When it comes to decarbonisation, our key strategies include things such as renewable energy in our factories, electric vehicles for distribution, also looking at the role of plant-based proteins, which I think is really interesting. I've mentioned food loss and waste. Dairy management, packaging is another big area that we shouldn't forget about within the context of climate change. I think the conversation recently within the sustainability space has put packaging as separate. It's absolutely not, as well as elements that the other speakers have mentioned, such as no deforestation and natural climate solutions, such as soil management, agroforestry, that kind of thing. Lots of work going on there in terms of decarbonisation and developing the roadmap. But beyond that, we also need to think back to, well, what does better resiliency look like in the supply chain and in agriculture? And that's where really the focus is on, how do we help build farmer resiliency? How do we take landscape level approaches that are really reflective of the local externalities, the pressures that those local environments are facing and those communities? And then how do we shift towards systems that are much more focused on regenerative agriculture, which is something that really does take time because it's fundamentally a change process as well. So it's very much about working in partnership with our sourcing communities, with our partners on the ground to help us make these system level shifts that we need to see, these transformations. So that's where we are. Loads of work still to do, and we definitely don't have all the answers to it. But for us, this is very much part of the systems transformation and the journey that we all need to be on, and recognizing the role that we individually can play as companies, but actually more importantly, and to Chris's point, what's the role that we can play as industry coming together collaboratively to actually get that scale and that momentum behind the change that we need to see.
Glad to hear you say that the next 10 years are critical. It seems to me that in the past there's been a tendency for companies to set goals quite a long way in the future and then say, we'll worry about getting to them when we get nearer to them. So 2050 is a line in the sand, as you said, but the next 10 years are important. How then do companies set the medium-term goals so that they know that they're hitting the milestones along the way?
To a certain extent, there's a little bit of test and learn going on here because this is relatively new territory for us. And also technology and data in particular continues to evolve. And I think part of the challenge historically has been the fact that we just don't really have consistent, globally applicable frameworks and data sets that are robust enough that we can kind of lean on in order to build and map ahead out of to our medium to longer term time horizons. Really focusing in on getting robust data has to be the starting point in order to respond to your question. Well, then how do you get to the medium-term time horizons? Because if you don't have that data in place, the ground that you're sitting on is not very stable. But thinking about that medium-term time horizon, we're very much focused on that data piece and making sure that we can get the robustness of it. In addition to the focus on the criticality of the next 10 years, we also have to be thinking about transition risk and be a little bit more explicit about, well, what does that actually mean? Because it's not really very well understood right now. We also need to start scenario testing. We need to scenario model. We need to look at bottom-up scenario planning, as well as the role of biodiversity in helping us to manage and mitigate. So that's also work that we're focusing on at the moment. In terms of our individual decarbonisation roadmaps, we're working through, as I said, at the moment, looking right along our individual business value chains. Given the complexity, but also the kind of specificity of the challenges faced within different commodity supply chains, you have to break it down supply chain by supply chain, and also look at that. What does that mean in terms of the flow of ingredients into manufacturing and then the output and where that ends up? So really looking how are products being sourced, manufactured, consumed in order to get the level of detail. We need to have some robust milestones in the medium to longer term.
If you want to join John Hixon in Minneapolis or Anna Terrell in London at Innovation Forum's Future of Food Conference Series, then don't forget you can save $300 for the US event or £300 for the UK one if you register now. And remember that there is plenty of other content available online at innovationforum.co.uk. Look out soon for a new piece of analysis on palm oil as a biofuel and a piece on the rise and rise of alternatives to meat, as well as all the usual podcasts and interviews. All available for free, of course, no paywalls at Innovation Forum. But that's all for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.